Hello, my name is Shayna Hertzfeld, and I am a student project manager for the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm here today with Hajira El-Sheikh, who is an entrepreneur, activist, and author. She is visiting Dickinson College to provide this year's Gender Week keynote address. She has spoken and written on this subject, including her memoir, Through Tragedy and Triumph, A Life Well Lived. In this interview, we will talk about Hajira El-Sheikh's life, including her experience as a child and young adult in Sudan, and her current work as an activist, advocate, and businesswoman. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you very much for having me and giving me the chance to be here with you.
So just starting at the beginning, so I've read your memoir, which was fascinating, and just starting at the beginning chronologically, you write in the opening part of your book about the effect that your parents and your siblings have had on your perspective and your life. So could you elaborate a little bit on their influence?
Sure. So for anyone that either grew up in Sudan or anywhere in that region, you will know that women throughout history in Sudan, they were put in a box, and there is traditions and gender roles, all of that applied. So you see most women are not allowed to go to school for specific jobs or education, or not allowed to wear certain clothes. So there are so many traditions. My family were liberal, and my dad basically fought not just his family but the society to raise me and my sisters that anything that my sibling, my brothers can do, we can do. With that in mind, I grew up trying to make it better and see injustice and try to do my part to make a difference. My father was an activist, he was a human rights and women rights activist, and he taught all of my siblings and I that when we see something, we need to say something.
I think that definitely came through in the book, and I think one of the other issues that's kind of related to that you discuss is female genital mutilation and your experiences with that in a slightly different vein. So I think in the United States, I think we often find it difficult to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of curious, how do you and how have you approached those sorts of conversations while you're navigating like the different cultural norms and societal norms? Because obviously there are differences between the United States and Sudan where you grew up.
Unfortunately, you might be surprised that female genital mutilation is practice in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that in the book. Yeah.
But it is still practiced heavily all around the world, and especially in Sudan and that region. There are regulations, and yes, there were laws put in place, but people find a way to still bypass that, right? Mm-hmm. So it was not easy to explain this experience, because if someone, for example, you grew up here, you don't know what female genital mutilation is. So you won't have a way to relate to it. Mm-hmm. You can relate to it just being a human, and you learn that this is something affecting someone. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to feel and know the extent unless you are taking healthcare major, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. And you will know that female genital mutilation is not just an emotional abuse, it is physical, and the consequences is a long term, not just a short term, but it affects women throughout their lifespan. When you have your period, you are going to feel pain more than anyone else. You feel difference. You're not gonna feel the same, because every time you go to the bathroom, you are reminded that you lost something. Childbirth is another issue. Not just the pain, but to have to relive, the same female genital mutilation over and over anytime you have a child. Relationship, intimate relationship with your partner. There's so much that you can explain to everyone around you from a different culture. They might feel, empathy, but they're not going to understand it to the extent. So, Every chance that I get, I do talk about it.
Yeah.
And women, and especially women from Sudan, this is a taboo. You don't get to talk about sex. You don't get to talk about your body, and especially your private. So few women you know, they have the courage and they have their family supporting mm-hmm. them and speaking out. So we just have to do it.
Yeah. You're like predicting my questions. So you talked already a little bit about some of the misconceptions, but I was going to ask about them. So I know you mentioned, like people think it's not still practiced in the US, which it is.
Yeah.
And you know, people don't have a way to, or they don't know about it unless they're in, you know, specific maybe academic context or learning yeah. about it in certain ways. Yeah. But are there any other like misconceptions that you've experienced?
Yes. A lot of people still think, not just in Sudan, but even in the US, they're questioning the religious aspect of mm-hmm. it. A lot of people think it is based on religion, mm-hmm. which is not. Even people in Sudan still think it is because of religious. A lot of people think it's a sign of purity,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially in a male-dominated society,
yeah.
where they view women as just body, mm-hmm. right? And you don't have rights over your own body.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all like misconceptions that people still believe in. A lot of people believe that it's a symbol of honor
mm-hmm.
for the family, to know that their daughter was pure, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of people still try to make a woman think this is a healthy practice
mm-hmm.
and it's for their own good.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the fact that it's done by women mm-hmm. to women,
yeah,
that's another problem.
Yeah. So shifting a little bit, and I know you've done work and activism work, you kind of alluded to it, surrounding female genital mutilation, but more generally, your political activism work and your work surrounding immigration, how do you think your work has been shaped by the experiences that you've had, specifically with the things that you're an activist about, which is so many things, but...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Everything that I do, it's based on my personal experience or some things that I've been through. Being a refugee, it is still, you know, no one, even with people talking about it
mm-hmm.
and having, say for example, here in the United States, we have a lot of refugees. This is a country built by mm-hmm. refugees, right? But it's still, refugees are looked at differently.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what I do is I share my journey. And honestly, some days my life feels like not real. Like it feels
yeah.
like a movie or
mm-hmm.
a nightmare that, you know, I'm going to wake up from it
yeah.
at some point. But with the torture and everything happening in Sudan,
mm-hmm.
I had no option.
Mm-hmm.
And so are many other women and men, but to flee the country.
Mm-hmm.
The other option was death.
Mm-hmm.
So many people think and look at refugees and think it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It is not.
Yeah.
No one wake up and choose to leave their home, leave
mm-hmm.
their memories,
yeah.
leave everything that they know and start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And like the unknown, human
yeah.
nature,
mm-hmm.
like we don't like the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So I was forced to leave Sudan and left everything that I know, like
mm-hmm.
my family, my friends, you know, and being there, you beat yourself over it because you feel like I let people down,
mm-hmm.
that I have ability to help and
mm-hmm.
I chose myself.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that battle
mm-hmm.
That you are facing personally, and then on top of that, you face the stigma. I was a refugee in Egypt for
mm-hmm.
Almost 8 months. Before I got settled in the U.S., a lot of people are not lucky like me.
Yeah.
My case was clear. You know, the U.N. was helping me,
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't, you know, a long time for me
yeah.
to stay. But it was a year and some.
Yeah.
So it's not a short time in a new country that you don't know anyone. You have no money.
Mm-hmm.
I faced homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So many days. You know, when I found out that I was pregnant with my oldest child,
mm-hmm.
I lived off dry bread
mm-hmm.
and tea.
Mm-hmm.
That's like,
yeah.
yeah. So, but, you know, a lot of people think that's the only thing that refugees choose to leave their countries. And refugees themselves think that, oh, the minute I'm gonna settle somewhere,
mm-hmm.
all my troubles are going to go away.
Yeah.
And that's not true, because you come to a third place,
mm-hmm.
you know, you start from zero and then you move again. Like I came to the US and I had to start from zero mm-hmm. again. And when you get to that point and you look around you and you thought you were safe,
mm-hmm.
and then you find that people are looking at you differently.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought that I'm here to take the job, you know? And
yeah.
I worked housekeeper, I worked mm-hmm. security. I did so many jobs that no one is dreaming about, you know?
Yeah.
No one just lay there and say, oh, my goal is to work as a security
mm-hmm.
person and walk around. So, you know, you hear that all the time. Go back to where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if you read the poem by Warsan Shire called Home.
I don't know if I've read it.
Okay, so look that up
and
hear it. And I did my own rendition of that. I'll read it to you at some point. But it's, you know, it's on us, not just to share our experience, but it's on the society to try to put yourself on somebody else's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to like face what other people faced and went through
right.
in order for you to care.
Mm-hmm.
We should care,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, you would hope so.
Yeah.
But so, again, shifting gears a little bit. It's so tough in these interviews because I feel like I'm constantly changing, but
okay.
we don't have very much time and we have
okay.
so much stuff to cover. So what has your experience been advocating for survivors of domestic violence? So I'll ask that generally first, and then I have kind of a follow-up.
Okay. So I'll just take you back a little bit
okay.
to, as a refugee,
uh-huh.
I thought when I saw my name on the board, and I got so excited,
yeah.
this is my second chance
mm-hmm.
in life. And I came here,
mm-hmm.
And then a couple years after, I start to see my ex-husband drinking.
Mm-hmm.
He's been drinking, but he started to drink heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a reason, like a lot of people when he was a refugee, just
mm-hmm.
like me, and we came together. A lot of people will not assimilate
mm-hmm.
the same way as
mm-hmm.
others, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there would be many reasons. But for me, in Sudan, you don't get to know your partner that much. You only know them after you marry because
mm.
of the culture and the
mm.
tradition. So I got to know him after we got married. We were in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
yes, but you don't get to live with the person or see them
mm-hmm.
as much. So when we came here, we had a door closed on just us,
mm-hmm.
right? And I start to see the violence, I start to see the abuse, the verbal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And normally abuse doesn't just, no one is going to come to you and say, I'm going to beat you
mm-hmm.
or I'm going to do this to you. It escalates. It starts with physical, with verbal, emotional, and just making you feel like you're not worthy. And then the physical started. When that happened,
mm-hmm.
You know, at that moment I didn't think of using my experience or anything to advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a survivor mode.
Right.
So you're just focused on how you can survive today
mm-hmm.
and leave the sea the next day. And after I was pregnant with my second child and I almost died
mm-hmm.
on his hand, I decided, is that what I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
So that got me to, you know, start filing for a divorce and getting out of it. During that process, he took all my money. I ended up for the fourth time to start from zero.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up with nothing. After that, I looked at myself and, you know, I realized that I knew I was strong because
mm-hmm.
I was fighting a whole regime.
Mm-hmm.
But yet again, I let someone abuse me for 4 years and did nothing
mm-hmm.
with it. And when I was working at the hospital, when we have someone come and they talk about their abuse, in my mind I was thinking, why are you staying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you judge, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I got in that position, I knew that there were more than one reason for a woman to stay in a domestic violence. And it was hard. I was facing, when I start talking about domestic violence, people were bashing me.
Mm-hmm.
Even family member,
mm-hmm.
don't air your dirty laundry.
Mm-hmm.
So I was seeing the pattern of abusing, the victim all over. So instead of just being abused by your abuser, the society is abusing you again and victimizing you over and over. So I decided that I need to do something. And, you know, I have a loud voice, so I decided to use it.
Yeah.
And I started the Tomorrow Smile nonprofit to help people who face the same thing. And normally people listen and relate when you've been there. So when I go and talk to victims of domestic violence, they can see me and say, you know what, if she can do it, I can.
Right, yeah.
So for that main reason, I started the domestic violence advocacy.
Yeah. Just as a little background, so my mom is a therapist and she does significant work with domestic violence, like survivors. And so I was just talking to her about this the other day, and she was saying, because I kept saying domestic violence survivor, and she said eventually, she was like, actually, she read something the other day that was, there was a switch of like language from survivor to, I actually texted her to ask what the switch was, but it was to thriver as opposed to survivor. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Yes. When I first start talking about this, I was referring to myself as a victim of domestic violence.
Yeah.
Then I had to change my language because referring to yourself and others as victims, you are placing them in that box. So they are going to feel as victim the rest of their life. But in fact, we survived it. Whether you are still traumatized or not, you've been there and you're out. So we switched to using survivors, right? After a while, a lot of talk was about, you know, when you talk about domestic violence survivors, you are putting the focus and the blame is still on the victim, the survivor, the thriver. So we, if you look at the any domestic violence language, you're going to hear domestic violence survivor, domestic violence victims, but you're not going to hear anything about the abuser. So we were trying to shift the focus to focus it on the person who's actually doing the abuse. So that's where people start to use
thriving.
I still use survivor, by the way.
So do I think it's hard to get out. And I think it also, to me, it seems like I think both have a place, you know, because when using the term survivor seems to honor the fact that someone has survived because it's such an intense experience, such a painful experience, and then also honoring the fact that they can thrive after that still. So I think it's cool that both have a place, but I was curious what you're
thinking. Surviving is a state. Like, you were a victim. You survived that victim mentality and being a victim, right? So you became a survivor. Then after you heal, you start the healing and you start to live your life as usual, then you thrived, right? So it's a process. That's why I thrived. But there's people still surviving and still healing. And there's still people are still victims even after they left. Because with domestic violence, you might leave the abuser, but are they going to leave you? That's the question, right?
So kind of in the last kind of thing we were talking about is like the idea of thriving, the idea of, you know, getting out of the survivor mentality, which can be so difficult to do. But you talk in the book about your experience starting a business and, you know, how that was so transformative for you. So I was curious if you have any advice for people, for women specifically, who want to start their own businesses or feel like that's something that might help them.
Definitely. This is not just for women who face a struggle. I always say, you know, education is power, knowledge is power. So when we talk to women to go to school, get a job, start a business, you don't have to have a abuser as a partner. That's for your own, you know, growth and your own knowledge. And a lot of people are afraid because, especially women, the society apply pressure on us. Make you feel every day that you're not worthy. Put obstacle in your way. Women, and especially minority women, are 10 times, they have to work 10 times harder than other women to achieve the same results that the, you know, you and I, if we were put in the same place, I will have to prove myself and I have to work as harder. So you, in that mentality, you find a lot of women don't do business or don't try to do that because it's the man's world. I'm going to tell you a short story. When I started my business, I got everything, like I learned, I got, went to Google, I start to inform myself about the business and get to know what I'm putting myself into. And during that, I learned that there is a place, small business administration, that they have free consultation. So I reached out to them. I asked them if they can help me and sit down with me. So a consultant came, sat down, and listened to everything that I had to say. I was a nurse at that time, and I'm doing my company in the same field. So he said, you know, you are smart. You sound like you know what you're doing. It is your field. So you should succeed. But I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be honest with you, you are going to fail. And he was an older white man, and he said, I am going to tell you, you will file bankruptcy in the first year. This is not a story. This is a true thing happened to me in 2012. He said, you are going to file bankruptcy the first year because you are a woman, you are a black woman, and you have an accent. So in that short interview or time, he like summarized me and used my culture identity as a reason for me to fail. He underestimated what I could do. He did not know who I am or what I survived. But he said two things that were actually true. He said, people are not going to take you serious. It is still a man's world. And especially when it comes to business, you're not going to get anywhere. You're going to face resistance and all of that. So hearing this, and then when I started my business, 6 months, every contract that I tried to get, I heard no. No one was giving me that. So at some point you doubt yourself and you think maybe he was right. And truly he was right. I mean, I did get my yes after 6 months, but then throughout those 10, 11, 12 years, I face pushback from many, many men or businesses. So I just wanted any woman out there who's thinking about starting a business not to let those circumstances stop her from achieving. You are going to hear no, you're going to get turned down, you're going to make to feel that you're not worthy, you're not good enough. But you know what? Prove them wrong and do it. And another thing that women need to do, or another advice, when you start your business and you see the struggle and you succeed, it open the door for the person behind you. You know, use your knowledge to help another woman uplift each other. Because the world is already hard enough on us. We don't need to make it any harder.
I'm not looking to go into the field of business, but I would imagine, I mean, if I was, I think it would be incredibly daunting to like set up a business from scratch. So much work. So,
but you can use this method with everything.
It's true.
You gotta put your foot down. You're gonna face people who are not going to believe in you, and you're gonna find people. This is the harsh reality. People are gonna look at you and say, you know, you're not gonna make it for school. And I'm sure you heard a lot when you were little. Bullying, it doesn't have to be just someone say, oh, you're ugly or this. You know, it could be like sugar-coated.
Everyone. At least every woman gets that at some point when they're growing up. So your memoir was published in 2019, and I was wondering, could you kind of like catch us up in your works and sense, so with your business as you were just talking about, but also in other work you've been doing with your activism and your, you know, your publications, all those things.
Okay, so I am in the process of publishing the second edition of the memoir. Adding more, of course, but we also were working on a novel from the book, so that's in like the writing side. The nonprofit, I'm still part of many organizations as a board of trustee. I started a Karimi's Mission. It's an autism awareness nonprofit also to add. Awesome. So that's, you know, I'm still doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just the load is more than before. And if, you know, a lot of people don't, I'm someone that like to stay busy.
Yeah,
and it's, to me, it's therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that I use my experience to help others, mm-hmm. it helped me as mm-hmm. well. It keep me grounded, and it also remind me where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, there's a lot happened.
Yeah, sure.
I give birth to a, he's going to be five
in May,
mm-hmm. and he was diagnosed with autism. And that's why I started a Karimi's mission. His name is Karim.
Okay.
So we started this nonprofit recently. Because also when I had this happen,
mm-hmm.
I learned the hard way that there is no more, there's not enough resources out there for parents,
mm-hmm.
and there's only few clinics that help kids with autism. The stigma, you know, the violence, the same with domestic violence, the cycle is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
People still treat and view kids with special needs as, you know, as a a problem
mm-hmm.
to have them.
Yeah.
They don't look at it as someone with different abilities mm-hmm. and you can help them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I didn't know about that, obviously, because it's new, which is so interesting. One of my cousins was around the same age as your son, actually,
mm-hmm.
was diagnosed with autism. And I know for my my stepsister, it's been a lot of the same things. And we have the same things in my house. Me and my sister, all three of us, actually,
mm-hmm.
are neurodivergent in some way, whatever
mm-hmm.
the brand of it is. And so, you know, we talk a lot about in my house of like, oh, well, you know, it's just different. It's not always better or worse.
Exactly.
It's just different. It's awesome that you have.
And there's a lot of people don't know that we all have form of our own differences. We are all different.
Right, yeah.
You just have to find how you can make your difference
mm-hmm.
work for you.
Right, exactly.
And that's basically what we're trying to do with the community at
mm-hmm.
large. But there is lack
mm-hmm.
of awareness.
Yeah, definitely.
And people feel ashamed about
mm-hmm.
talking about this.
Yeah.
That's another thing. When I start posting about, you know, my son when he was little, I start to notice the signs. I start to face resistance even from his dad
mm-hmm.
and his family and everyone around.
Yeah.
Like, don't post that on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, people mm-hmm. are going to look at him different. Like, yeah, he is different.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he's bad.
Right.
Doesn't
right.
mean he's good.
Right.
It's just his own unique way.
Yeah.
And we just need to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't feel this way,
mm-hmm.
what is the other world is going to feel about him?
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
not going to be kind to him, right?
Yeah, right.
So we just need to find our voice
mm-hmm.
and we need to advocate
mm-hmm.
and not be the voice
mm-hmm.
for the voiceless, because you don't want to take their
right.
voice away.
Yeah, that's a good
you
point.
Just want to amplify.
Right.
You want to use your privilege
mm-hmm.
and we all have privileges.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You might say, what privileges do you have as a black woman and
yeah.
an immigrant, someone
yeah.
who had everything going
yeah.
on?
Yeah.
I do. I told you at the beginning, I have a loud voice
yeah.
and I make sure I use it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just sort of wrapping up, always a good question to ask at the end is, do you think there's anything we haven't talked about? We've obviously covered a very wide range of issues, but is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to add?
Not really. The only thing that I will just, you know, encourage people to do is
mm-hmm.
to know that you can make a difference.
Yeah.
I can't say this enough.
Mm-hmm.
Education is the key,
mm-hmm.
truly. And you don't have to travel outside of the United
right,
States
right.
of Pennsylvania.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
we have a diverse
yeah.
Community here. Embrace that difference,
mm-hmm.
you know? And just get to know people before you judge them. We are fast to judge. We are
yeah.
fast to be negative. We're fast to label people and stereotypes and put people in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, life is too short. We can all fit together and we can all, you know, live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just a utopia, you know?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the only thing I'll say, just, you know, try to be the change that you want to see in the world. This is
yeah.
actually my network slogan
uh-huh.
on the Hajira Network. We from day one when we started, it's be the change that you want to see in the world.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing I'm asking from everyone.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, that's a wonderful place to end. So thank you so much for being here with us. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I appreciate your time.